and its effects. Personal sin, the results of free consent.
In England, of course, in Scandinavia, Denmark, and also the secular society that was coming into existence as a result of the conflict between church and state, where, as a matter of fact, the only logical solution seemed to be to, as it were, well, de-religionize society, in as much as you couldn't have one single civil society somehow harmonized with a variety of religions. We said something about his appeal to the binding power of civil law. Now that had special relevance to the people, particularly in England, for whom he was mainly writing. He has long several years controversy with James I, who, as you know, assumed complete autocratic power over the people, created great problems of conscience, not just for Catholics, but for anyone who disagreed with the crown. And consequently, while on the side of the king in pleading with him to let go the fiction of his having direct power from God, which really became an arbitrary power, Bellarmine correspondingly appealed to the people to realize that, after all, James was their legitimate sovereign, not only he, but elsewhere too, but particularly James, and that the binding power of civil law arises first of all from reason. Given civil society, you must have a ruler. In the present structure of human existence, without someone who has ultimate executive, judicial, and legislative power, howsoever interpreted, society becomes chaotic. And then from Revelation, well, he especially appealed to those passages in Paul and Peter too, in which it is said, whatever authority there is from God. It is significant that the relative, I say relative, patience with which the persecutions were borne, both by Catholics and by the nonconformists, was due partly at least to Bellarmine's writing. There were, of course, other divines who wrote at the same time, appealing to the people's sense of equity and to be able to distinguish between the holder of authority, which he has from God the authority, and abuses of that authority, which, of course, in conscience, they either couldn't do as they conform to the established religion or and suffer for their nonconformity. Finally, Bellarmine wrote at great length, at such length, in fact, that he got in difficulty with even some of the least local ecclesiastical authorities for his distinguishing between two kinds of ecclesiastical authority, or better, two aspects of it. Now, while the concept had been in theology for centuries, it had never so clearly, you might say, had to be enunciated as was demanded by the new situation in the 16th and 17th centuries. Two kinds of ecclesiastical authority over, well, two different kinds of things which you might say the church or any authority might have a right to govern. In things spiritual, this was Bellarmine's distinction, in things spiritual, the church has direct authority. Now, the terminology is Bellarmine's. The concept goes back, way back. But it had never really to be invoked. And ever since Bellarmine's time, it's the solution for a multitude of problems. Over things directly spiritual, or rather over things immediately spiritual, the church is said to have direct authority. Meaning what? Meaning it can dictate policy, it can pass laws, it can bind people in conscience to obey, say, receiving the sacraments, believing, and so on. But the real test of the church's, you might say, even existence was what kind of authority the church had in things which are not immediately temporal. Pardon me, things which are not immediately spiritual, but which are somehow temporal. In other words, what is the relationship of the church to the state? course, behind it is a whole philosophy of authority and concept of society, which we just can't go into. It's a course by itself. You see, he had already distinguished clearly between two societies, admitting, as had always been admitted, that the church is a society which has a right to its own existence, its own means of subsistence, and correspondingly, by the will of Christ, the state too is a society, and in its own way perfect, namely having a right to using the means which it considers requisite for the furtherance of its aims. What are its aims? Well, he said, the two societies ultimately are distinguished by their purposes. The purpose of an ecclesiastical society or of the church is spiritual welfare of those who belong. The purpose of civil society is the temporal, this worldly, material, properly understood, peace and prosperity of the citizens. The problem is a crucial one. It goes all the way back to, well, the beginnings of Christian emancipation under Constantine. But the problem really never became crucial because, well, you might say, by definition, civil society was more than sympathetic with the established church. But the moment you had, and this was more than a moment, this is 100 years of development, of a new concept of society, which, to say the least, was not Catholic, I mean the civil society, rulers who were either unsympathetic, or even no matter how sympathetic they might be, a man like, say, Charles V, no matter how sympathetic he might be to the Catholic cause, he recognized early there was a pluralistic religious profession within his domains. And consequently, to what extent does the church have authority over things which are not immediately and overtly spiritual? Bellarmine's distinction was it has authority which is indirect, and then, to explain what the word indirect means, Bellarmine appealed to that very controversial figure of the Middle Ages, Boniface VIII. You may remember his bull called Unam Sanctam, a highly controversial thing in which he took issue with the French king of the time, who, if you recall, had, among other things, presumed to tax the clergy to support the wars. The Pope remonstrated, and the net result was a long series of altercations. And finally, a document by Boniface VIII, which not only need be read in its context, or should be read in its context, but Bellarmine found in it a perennial principle, where although Boniface VIII is regularly accused, and almost any book you pick up, except by one who really knows what he's talking about, you will find him regularly accused of having, you might say, of typifying the acme of papal, you might say, autocracy, of claiming complete dominion, not only over the souls, but even over the bodies of men, in other words, not only over things spiritual, but even over things temporal. Now, the question is, what kind of right did, in Bellarmine's terminology, Boniface vindicate that the church has even over, say, civil rulers, or more concretely, say, over civil laws and so on? Well, following and using Boniface's terminology, which was about 400 years before, the famous phrase, which Bellarmine lifted to a theological principle, Ratione Peccati, what does it mean? Well, it means, and it meant, by the way, for Boniface already, although naturally the society was much more closely knit, civil society, with the church, and consequently the frequency with which this would be invoked would be greater, and the sensitivity of the church to civil encroachments on the conscious people would be greater. Nevertheless, the basic idea is this. The church, in Bellarmine's terminology, has a right to, well, exercise authority over things, even civil or secular, whenever there is question of sin. Ratio, as you know in Latin, can mean almost anything. It's like thing in English. Ratione is the ablative. By reason of sin, that would be the literal translation of ratione peccati. Whenever, in other words, the state, in the judgment of the church, and of course this is where the rub comes in, whenever in the judgment of the church, civil authority, civil law, civil jurisdiction, so imposes itself on the consciences of the people as to expose them to sin. Now, thus it might be a law that they are told to obey, which they cannot. It would be against their conscience. Or it might be imposing burdens on them that make it impossible, or near impossible, to satisfy their, say, their religious obligations. Like now in communist-occupied territory, say in East Germany, well, I understand, they will regularly, during the times of religious service, and by the way, East Germany, as you know, is mostly 80% Protestant, regularly on Sunday mornings and up to the mid-afternoon, they will have all kinds of youth demonstrations, youth rallies, gymnastic exercises, athletic feats, all sorts of things that young people would be, say, attracted to, and which all kinds of pressure is put upon them to participate in, and as a consequence, people who have very recently, the last year, late 63, even, been in East Germany, they say, for all practical purposes, the churches are empty of the young people, barring a few hardy souls, perhaps the unathletic type that nobody cares about anyhow. Well now, see, that would, according to this principle, be an encroachment on the conscience by reason of sin. Meaning what? Meaning that it would inhibit, to say the least, the exercise of one's religious belief, say, on the question of a Sunday observance. And according to Bellarmine, therefore, the church is believed to have indirect authority over, if you wish, the state, or over things civil, insofar as there is a question of sin, insofar as laws or the conduct of civil society would go against the conscience or the religious beliefs and corresponding practice of those who are Christian. Now, significantly, without dwelling on the point, this distinction has found its way into all Western law. And about a half a dozen of the classic decisions of our own Supreme Court in the United States. The Mormon case back in the late 19th century, other cases since then, have regularly been decided on the score that the state has no right in any way to inhibit or prevent the exercise of, say, one's religion, provided that, and of course this is from another viewpoint, provided that the common good is not injured thereby. Thus the Mormons were sat on, not because they held polygamy, which if it were held as a theory would be harmless enough, or if it involved just some ritual practice would be correspondingly innocuous, but it raised the grave problem of, well, where do you get the extra women when nature provides an almost one-to-one relationship? Some of the anti-Mormon writers said, it's unjust, of whatever else it is.
They're 5-1 already in some races, so don't worry.
In favor of whom, Charlie?
In favor of the women.
Favor of the women?
Yes, in the Jewish.
Which vindicated the IM movement, and in a way has opened the gates wide open to the whole new thought business. Mail order business, some say it's over 20 million people who somehow participate in this kind of, you might say, spiritual uplift. And the decision of the Supreme Court was on the score of the states having no right to inhibit the belief, of course, or even the practice, ritual or otherwise, of a religious belief, no matter how bizarre or strange or unbelievable it may seem to somebody else, that's, so the Supreme Court said, that's the nature of faith. The only limit they put, which of course had been set, say, by the Mormon decision, is if the common good is injured thereby. And they say we cannot see how there is any massive threat to the welfare of the nation because some people want to pay $5 or $10, whatever the cost is, for purported communications from on high. The point, though, is, you see, a respect, this is now in obverse, right? The civil society's realization that there are inherent spiritual rights, or from the viewpoint of the church, which is Bellarmine's position, that the church may tell the civil law so far and no further, where in the judgment of the church there is some imposition on the consciences of the people. Well, we could go on at great length. Any questions before we take up the interesting and tragic subject of sin? Yes, Ken.
I'd like to hear.
I don't know of any existing books on the history of sin, but it'd be very interesting reading, and actually, I suppose, much of history is the history of, at least, the effects of sin. But theologically, that means significance in my creation. The significance of sin in the history of theology is paramount. In fact, in Christian theology, along with grace, and in a way sin is the opposite of grace, it is the history of Christian theology. Just to illustrate for a moment, suppose Christianity did not believe that man had originally sinned. If he hadn't sinned, no one would have inherited or had got the sin from our first parents. There would have been no need of one to remove the sin. There would have been no Christ. There would have been no Christianity. Moreover, theological positions in Christianity can, I think, best be defined. Their clarity stands out with all the sharpness of a nicely etched engraving. When you find out what is the position which, say, this system or that person or whoever, whatever it is, on the subject of sin. And as we will see with our three men that we're handling, the Augustinian, the medieval or scholastic, and then the Reformation and Counter-Reformation positions, all represent, really, you could summarize all their theology in what they held and taught regarding sin. Whether there is such a thing as sin, what is it? How do you get rid of it? What do you do about it? What are its effects? Now, the development can be seen in many stages. I have only four here. Well, because it's the nature of our course. But really, those four pretty much represent even modern positions on the subject of sin. In other words, since the Reformation, there has been no major theological crisis in Christianity. That's a large statement. The nearest thing to a crisis, except now in obverse or in reverse, is the ecumenical movement. As far as the New Testament goes, the existence of sin, the consequences of sin, are all over the New Testament. You can't read anything in the New Testament without meaning sin. However, the New Testament has, as such, no theology on the subject of sin. That is not the nature of the New Testament. The New Testament, as we know, is a composition of writings to meet the occasion, to summarize the faith, the teachings of Christ, his life, but without going into the theological dimensions or depth. With the patristic age, however, and by patristic age, remember, we always mean the age of the fathers of the church, of whom Augustine is, by all odds, the towering genius. He, in a way, summarizes the best of the patristic age. In the patristic age, we have the beginnings, and more than just beginnings, of a theology of sin created as the fathers of the church themselves were created by those who challenged either the existence of sin or its nature or its effects or its means of removal. And what is little recognized and seldom appreciated, Pelagianism, which we're going to touch in a moment because that was Augustine's great preoccupation, the basic thing which he denied was sin. A nice, neat definition of Pelagianism is the denial of sin, in the sense of something which a person is born with, see, and which, unless Christ enters his life, he won't be saved. Now, Augustine, we'll see, handled two main theological challenges to the nature or existence of sin, Manichaeism and Pelagianism. We'll take it up in sequence. In the Middle Ages, there have been no major challenges to the nature of sin. By and large, the Western world was Christian, and even the conflicts with Islam, such as we know of, say, in Southern Europe, particularly in Spain, or in East Asiatic Christianity, did not directly, or at least not much, touch on the subject of sin. At any rate, as you know, the Middle Ages theologically, and certainly in St. Thomas, are the age of synthesis, and consequently we find, with apologies again for a variety of breakdowns, not really breakdowns, but analysis, insight into the meaning. Up to, you might say, the Middle Ages, the problem was to, well, save sin, save its existence. And under the relative leisure, so to speak, at least lack of conflict or war, theological, the Middle Ages could settle down to figure out, now, what's this all about? And Aquinas' theology of sin is a vast panorama. We'll just pull out some of the major issues, major concepts that he found in the nature of sin. Then in Bellarmine's time, sin, of course, was admitted by the Reformation, but gave a new or different interpretation to the nature of sin, but especially to its effects. And as a consequence, the Counter-Reformation, of which Trent and Bellarmine are the exemplars, now clarify things that were very implicit in Catholic teaching prior to, say, the Reformation. So we take them up in sequence. And I would like to finish the subject of sin, if I could, today, although I'm a bit doubtful. First, therefore, with Augustine. Until the Manichaeans came on the scene, there was no real, certainly no really intelligent challenging of the existence, certainly existence of sin, or even of its nature. The Manichaeans, as we mentioned in a previous context, are an Oriental import, Persian, you might say, born of a composite of Zoroastrianism, of Gnosticism, of Judaism and Christianity, somehow synthesized in a man called Manes, and going back in terms of its premises to the old Zoroastrian dualism that we spoke about, I think, didn't we, in one class, of opting for a metaphysical instead of a merely moral dualism. Now, Augustine's genius consisted, first of all, remember, he was a Manichaean for some years. This is seldom recognized. He was a Manichaean. And consequently, he could speak from, you might say, both having read and having experienced, in many ways, the savor of Manichaeism. It was nectar to his intellectual lips. It made sense. It solved a lot of big problems. It created new ones, but what system doesn't have problems? So, what Augustine therefore challenged
in Manichaeism was the basic issue raised. Not as to the existence of sin, except the moment you redefine sin in Manichaean terms, it's a new idea. It's maybe sin yet, but my, what a difference. What Augustine recognized as crucial here was whether or not the human will is the cause of sin. That was the issue. If there is such a sin, thing as sin, whatever it is, call it deviation from right order, call it, irrationality, call it the source of conflict, call it the built-in chaos in human existence, you name whatever name you give it. In Manichaean terminology, the source of that somehow was outside of man. Now, ultimately, it would be some kind of a deity. Who was, if you can speak of it as a who, independent of the good deity. It corresponded, of course, to the old pagan determinism found already among the Egyptians and Babylonians, certainly among the Greeks and the Latins, symbolized in that famous term fatum, which we should never forget, for the Latins, as found in almost every page, every 10 verses of Virgil. Fatum, or the plural fata, are those impersonal forces which stand above all the gods, including Jupiter. And inexorable, unanswerable, and in no sense contingent on any force above them. Well, some of this, in other words, Manichaeism is, it's paganism trying to work its way into Christianity. It was a death struggle and something had to give in. Either Christianity would cease to be Christian and become what paganism had always been, or Christianity would be vindicated, and Augustine happened to be the champion of Christianity in its conflict with Manichaeism. I'd like to I checked through the possible quotations and I found there were over 100, literally 100 quotations I could quote from Augustine on this subject in this book. This book contains about 3,000. That is from different sources. I just want to read this. It'll be a little halting English. He is here writing against a famous Manichaean by the name of Felix. And he's writing as late as 404, which means that Augustine is, by this time, a mature man and has been a Christian for some time. He is arguing to prove that sin somehow must arise from the human will, from human beings. And he appeals to the scriptures, which, curiously perhaps, the Manichaeans, being so they call themselves Christians, accepted. So, and it happens, by the way, just coincidentally, well, not quite so coincidentally, he's quoting the passage from Matthew that was read in last Sunday's Gospel. Remember the good tree bearing good fruit and the bad tree bearing good fruit? And how could a bad tree bear good fruit? So, it gets complicated after a while. Well, he quotes the passage from Matthew. When, therefore, it is said, or Christ says, either do this or do that, be good and don't be bad, it indicates some kind of a power. It does not describe a nature. What he means is this. It does not describe something which is, you might say, in nature, over which man has no control, no power. For no one but God, this is speaking of the tree, no one but God can make a tree. Isn't that something? This is a question. Nemo nisi Deus fossori albor in potens. Nobody but God can make a tree. But each human being has in his power, in his will, to choose things that are good and thus to make a good tree, or to choose things that are bad and thus to make a bad tree. Well, there's a lot behind that figure, see? God makes the nature, which God, man then can, by his choice, make either good or bad. And more of the rest. Augustine's position, therefore, is one that we've seen already. Yes?
You've broken the law.
However, see, that was his business. His business was to vindicate the necessity of grace and so on. And as a consequence, there may be an obscuration of Augustine's re-insistence and emphasis on man's responsibility for what he does wrong. It is he, Augustine, who said, and this is well worth remembering, all virtue, as all sin, are in the human will. All virtue, as all sin, are in the human will. It is man's will that either does good, or if it wants to, perversely, does evil. As I say, that's something which then Aquinas came along and built a whole system of, really, of theology using Aristotle's structure to the virtues, which we can briefly touch upon. Anyhow, Augustine's great contribution to the theology of sin, his conflict with Manichaeism, was to identify the real cause of evil. And incidentally, as you find in reading the City of God, even physical evil. Well, we don't want to get lost now, and we want to finish up. See, in Augustine's theology, in his conflict, with the Manichaeans, Augustine was at pains to, well, disprove their claims that the source of all evil in the world is from outside of man. Of course, you've got to then postulate some kind of forces which are by themselves evil, which are causing all of this evil. But he easily distinguished, as anybody would, between two kinds of evil, namely the moral and the physical. Now, there's a connection which we referred to in, I think, our last class, but that Augustine dwelt on at length. Because while it's the human will that directly causes moral evil, which is another word for sin, in its conflict with the will of God. In fact, his famous definition of sin is the deliberate deviation from the will of God. Deliberate deviation from the will of God. Deliberate implying knowledge. Deviation means that it's something contrary to, and what? God's will. And God couldn't cause it himself. He couldn't cause it. He may allow it. But he went on a step further, which is typically Augustinian, and meaning is his whole concept of providence, that all physical evil has in turn somehow been called, that universal is a shivering universal, all physical evil in the world has somehow been caused by moral evil. It doesn't mean that this man here caused this physical evil. His sins caused his death, or because he was bad, he broke his leg. Or, this, by the way, might deserve a little explanation. You may have heard in the life story of Horace Mann. Horace Mann, as you know, is the reputed founder of common education in the United States. He had been a Presbyterian, a rather staunch Presbyterian. Well, yes, his family was very strong, but he himself had been a churchgoer as a youngster. He tells the story about himself and what happened to him, to his mind, and to his thinking. Probably about 15 or 16 years old, when his kid brother, I think his name was Henry, played hooky from church one Sunday morning, young Henry, to go fishing and drown while fishing. A couple of days later, the funeral was held at the local church, and Horace says, in fact, he gives the sermon verbatim, at least in his own words.
in which the young kid was for about 20 minutes consigned to hell, and it was producibly clear to the minister, and he was trying to make clear to the audience, that this is the way God deals with those who break his will. Horace said, "I left that church an unbeliever." He never believed again. He never believed again. He became a great humanitarian, did a lot of good. He never believed again, he says. So, this is well to know that we're not talking about any such crudity. See? But there is a sense in which I'm talking now in Augustine's terms. There is a sense in which moral evil, sin that is, see, has somehow brought on, and this of course is good Christian theology, even the physical evils that befall man, admitting and willingly conceding that even the most innocent, in fact sometimes the most innocent, may suffer physically the most, either in terms of natural calamity or of human perversity, that they have been the last ones responsible for what they suffered. But that's another story. That's part of the complex of providence. Nevertheless, the overall purview is an important one. See? It explains a lot of things, at least within the ambit of the Christian faith. But what we want to specify in Augustine is this thing, see? It's the human will, it's inside of man, and not, therefore, from something outside of him, as in one of Shakespeare's plays, is in the stars. Now, where is that occurring? Juliet. Romeo and Juliet? Remember the context? Sister?
In Julius Caesar, that there's a line that says, it is not in our stars that we are what we are, but because we did not will at the proper time when we were supposed to will.
Would you watch? Would you like looking up that passage? See? Shakespeare is talking in Augustinian terms. At least you see, and the pagan concept, what we call pagan complacency, and even the non-Christian concept, and in teaching as I have ancient comparative religion, and having read at least as much as I have time for of the great writings of the ancient religions, there is that fatalism, see? There is that inevitability, there is all that happens, the very word happened, is an unchristian term, because usually we speak of things happening as being somehow bad.
There's also in Julius Caesar the line that goes, there is a tide in the affairs of men, which if taken at its full leads on to success, but which if not taken at its full leads to disaster, which that always seemed to me was the action of human will, because you take that circumstance and act on it. But if you don't,
well, as a matter of fact, that is true. Shakespeare, as you know, is the subject of a bad examination. In fact, a classmate of mine, a Jesuit, did his doctorate at Stanford in English literature on Shakespeare's theology of sin. And it is well to see what we're dealing with, don't see? Shakespeare's theology of sin.
I was just going to say that line from 54, it's not in our stars, it's in ourselves, is when Cassius is speaking to Brutus, but talking about him, about their rising in the world rather than sin. This is talking about how Caesar has risen, though they are the same human being.
So it isn't exactly sin, it's rather achievement of some kind. Nevertheless, it implies, however, the existence of a force which is either good or bad, and you are, as it were, the pawn in it.
Well, all those soliloquies, the soliloquy of Brutus just before he decides whether or not he will kill Julius Caesar, runs through the whole gamut of what the consequences of sin will be, and also, it's a very clear delineation of what goes on in a man's mind while the temptation is taking place. And also, Macbeth, before he commits the sin, and after, just before the end of the play, where he realizes...
Ultimately, three concepts of tragedy, depending on your concept of sin, or of evil, of moral evil. The one he called the Porosides, the Greco-Roman, the second the Christian, and the third the existentialist. And he said the Greco-Roman describes tragedy in terms of some kind of force outside of you, which really is or may be against you, which keeps opposing you, and keeps crushing you, and finally it does, in the denouement, as it were, of the tragedy, you are crushed by it, but the hero of a typical Greek tragedy is one who stands strong in the face of that. And you are, you're saddened by the inevitability, but you are heartened by the courage. Well, sister, I'm quoting. Finish, please, sister.
Yes,
He was speaking of typical, see, typical. Mm-hmm. Then in the Christian, he says, all tragedy implies some kind of suffering. But instead of saying that the suffering is caused by something which is really outside of you, something inexorable, something fatal, fatalistic in the sense of you're not having been responsible for it, in Christian tragedy at its purest, the victim of the tragedy somehow was the cause of his own sufferings. And then what Greco-Roman thought never clearly conceived, there are perceptions, there were insights, but never clearly perceived, that the one who is a hero, as it were, is one who recognizes both his own part in having brought it on, and then his own inability to weather the storm, to overcome the evil or the suffering, and calls upon a power outside of himself, which would be grace, or calling upon God's help. And then in the existentialist, which he, the modern type of tragedy, where you have the same conflict, and it is again somehow some inexorable force, somehow nature, or man himself, or circumstances. But it's something which is blind, which is has no apparent purpose in its having come upon you and the sufferings that it causes you. But otherwise, the hero of Greek tragedy, this man, is crushed by it, and it leaves you with a sense of despair. And as typical, if I can recall the examples, and of course he was immediately controverted, and I think, sister, you wanted to controvert me. He was talking about pure streams. He thought, I think it was, the Antigone as fairly typical of the Greek. Lear as fairly typical of the Christian. And death comes to a salesman, Miller's, as fairly typical of the modern. Anyhow, the difference, apart from other, I'm going to have to make this a parenthesis. But you do see, though, the issues that are at stake. And the basic idea is whether or not that which befalls you, which really isn't sin, because not necessarily, sufferings may not be sinful, yet are somehow caused either by you or by human beings, or come from a force over which man is somehow powerless. So Augustine would opt for the human will having brought on the moral evil, in fact having caused it, and then having brought in its wake, at least cosmically speaking, other evils, which would be called physical, which are the concomitants and consequences of the moral. Sister, you have a question I can't forbear not asking. What is it?
No.
It's of Christianity, and of course, coming into conflict with the genius of Augustine.
There's one thing I want them to remember, though, is that first statement you made that was very clear about this born man in Oedipus Rex, that although he is subject to fate, you know, that is in the Greek tragedy, that ultimately, and he goes down, Oedipus goes down, it's very hard to understand, yet he ultimately, there is a dignity about it. He maintains your belief in human dignity. And there is a co-op. Yes, I mean, that's a very...
Yes, that is point. True, that is true. That's, and that's the heartening, that's the heartening part. Mm-hmm. But also, I should have added something that at least President Roberts pointed out for the Christian dimension, that not only does a person have to appeal to a power outside of himself, which by the way he has opposed and somehow must be reconciled to, but that there is an ultimate victory. There is a beyond, even though not spelled out in, say, the individual tragedy. There is a hope beyond the immediate tragedy, even though not seen, and only vaguely surmised by the object.
Well, I was just thinking while you're talking, I was thinking about Homer and the other
concept. He demands all responsibility for his.
Don't you find this in Thucydides to help mention more besides that?
Well, undoubtedly, what we're trying to say is that there was a theology which was antithetical, or at least was quite obverse to what we typically recognize as the Christian. A purposefulness, first of all, a consequence to man's misdeeds, and a purposefulness even to his sufferings. Shall we go on, ladies and gentlemen? Pelagianism. So this, of course, has been touched upon already. We just want to see it now in the unique context of sin. The big thing, of course, with the Pelagians was the denial of original sin as something which was inherited by the human being. The Pelagians under duress admitted that, all right, Adam did sin. But they asked smugly, so what? Their claim was that while he sinned, the only harm, if there was any, that he caused his children and progeny was the bad example which he set up. Now, the word is a cliche, bad example. It meant there were certain things which had been done and by tradition had been passed on. But the evil, and this is the essential thing, the evil according to the Pelagians, the evil that was caused to human nature was purely extrinsic. See, this is Pelagian. It was outside of man's nature. Man's nature as such remained intact. And Augustine's main preoccupation with the Pelagians was to insist and to prove, going back to the teachings of the Gospels and on through the Christian Church for 300 years, to show that, no, it's not only, it's that too, but there is something happened to human nature as such. Human nature now is worse as human nature. It isn't only that you grow up and you see your mother or father misbehaving. Now, you don't have an example of, say, a Christian home or the kind of a home that you would have had Adam and Eve way back, not sin. No. Even before you're born, in the very conception, we inherit some primordial sin. Now, the passages in Augustine on this subject are numerous. Perhaps the clearest passage or passages deal with what he referred to before, namely the baptism of infants. In other words, in order to excavate and to prove that there is something in human nature which is wrong or has been worsened as a result of the fall, he asked, why, first of all, do you baptize infants? And the answer was yes. Do you have to? And there was the question. It was not only the practice that he appealed to, but the necessity. And, well, to, you might say, his own satisfaction and to the satisfaction of a whole system of theology, he vindicated the fact that baptism from the beginning had been considered necessary, and necessary for those who had not sinned personally, indicating there was something in their soul for which they were not personally responsible. Long before they could have sinned personally or have followed, say, the bad example of anybody. A child crying or whatever other misconduct children commit can scarcely be put down to their imitating their parents. The next distinction that Augustine made, besides its being something intrinsic, is between the guilt and the punishment or the consequences of this sin. And this was important because the question then arose, whence the, you might say, the condition of man with all his weakness, his irrational drives and urges, in a word, his concupiscence. See? How come? Where does it all come from? Well, the Pelagians, what else could they say except, say, well, That's pretty much the condition of man. Whereas Augustine distinguished between inhabitual sin, the guilt, and the effects that are inherited, in other words, a child, even before being born, certainly before the age of reason, has inherited both the stain of sin and estrangement from God, and the effects. Two principal ones being mortality and the loss of integrity, the loss of that kind of built-in self-control of the passions which we associate with, say, our first parents before the fall. As a consequence of their fall, their posterity inherited both the guilt, which is estrangement from God, and the effects, which you might say be the punishment that was consequent. And here Augustine, among other places, he points out that when a person is justified, when he receives grace, he is now arguing to what happens to a person when he is justified in the context of Pelagianism. And he says, well, we believe that grace removes the guilt, removes the estrangement from God. The person now becomes a friend of God, which he hadn't been, or the child hadn't been before. But as far as the evils, which are consequent on his having inherited that guilt, he is given the power to overcome them. But as experience so dramatically proves, we still have those evils. He's talking about grace. He says, grace perfectly changes or renews a man insofar as pertains to his liberation from all his sins, that is, as far as removal of the guilt, the estrangement. However, it does not mean that in virtue of his receiving grace, he is freed from all evils or from all corruption, see, of mortality, with which, perforce, human nature is still, even after justification, so pathetically beset. See? Now, what he was doing, of course, we don't want to go into all the angles of this. What he was trying to do was to refute the Pelagians in their claims that nothing happened to human nature. See? He was trying to saddle them with the responsibility for man's being in the condition in which he is, uniquely because God made human nature such. See? Being human, the Pelagians had, so Augustine confidently felt, all the temptations, passions, and concupiscences that anybody else had. See? And he wanted to appeal not to their reason so much, perhaps, as to their experience. Now look here, he said, in so many words to the Pelagians. Do you have passions? Do you have irrational drives? You have all kinds of insane urges. Are you tempted? Do you suffer? Are you afraid to die? And he hoped he would say yes. Well, then he says, all right now, how come? Where'd you get it? Either, therefore, and he was trying to, you say, pin them on the horn of one of the dilemmas. Either they would deny, which, being human, they could scarcely deny, they would be beset with all these evils. Or if they admitted the evils, then whence the evils? Either God made man so, and he is so because God wants him so, or something happened to man as a consequence of which he is worsened. See? He was working his way back to making man inherit something, and he was arguing from the effects to having some explanation for the cause. I think you see what Augustine was driving at. At any rate, with the Pelagians, his concern was to prove the existence of sin as inherited from our first parents. And with the Manichaeans, who denied really that there is sin in the sense of being caused by a human being, with the Pelagians, you might say it was kind of an obverse, see? It's almost like a compromise with Manichaeism, doesn't it? saying that, well, this somehow comes from outside of man, at least outside of my own will. There is some kind of a built-in weakness. There is a tendency to sin, see, which I have even before I begin to use my reason. So between Manichaeism and Pelagianism, you have spanned both foci, the polarity of the Christian faith, see, both insisting on man's ultimate responsibility and, against the Pelagians, admitting there are drives in the direction of evil, see, which have not been brought on, at least, by individuals for themselves. Well, now one more thing. Extent. Who had this original sin? Now this, by the way, Catholics have always appealed to and was appealed to already by the Council of Trent. He was also appealed to by Pius IX when he declared Mary to be without original sin. The famous passage let's be sure to find it. Ad Gratia, written in 415, again in the 2 years. It occurs, by the way, in chapter 36, section 42. He's talking about sin, and specifically original sin. Except, I'm quoting Augustine, the Blessed Virgin Mary, about whom, because of the honor of God, when there is question of sins, where he includes original sin, I wish there to be no question. In other words, when we treat of sin and the inheritance of original sin, where is the question of the Blessed Virgin Mary, because of the honor of God, she having born the deity in her womb, I want there to be no question, as though she inherited the sin. This, as I say, Trent, back in the 16th century, appealed to without defining the Immaculate Conception. Pius IX in the mid-19th century used, among others, this text of Augustine.
You're saying that Mary, even before the conception, was without original sin.
Well, not before the conception. At conception. Before the conception, she wasn't.
Yeah. That's what I want to be clear about.
So this, in other words, this does not say, you're right, Mother, Augustine does not here say she was immaculate, you can see. Okay? But the patristic tradition, what I'm saying, I'm just trying to expose some of the sources for, as far as sin is concerned, it happens to be in the context of Pelagianism. That's my problem. So that, in other words, that she never had any sin, which then the church later on came along to interpret as meaning, if she never had it, well, she never had it. Well, the Catholic teaching is even before birth. In other words, from the first moment of conception, from the first moment that she had a rational soul. Now the question is to what point, when the rational soul is infused, from the first moment that she was a human being. She was justified. Justified at conception, that's what it was come to.
Well, what do you base that on? I mean, this is...
I would quote Augustine, the honor of God. In other words, it would have been so. Augustine, who did not, as such, speak of the Immaculate Conception. But later, theologians would, that it would have, have been unworthy of God, it would have been conceived in a creature who had at any time been a slave of Satan.
Well, really, other words, you're saying that Mary...